The 2015 Major League Baseball All-Star Game marks the fifth time that the annual showcase of the game's best players comes to Cincinnati. The first two times were at Old Crosley Field. Twice it was at Riverfront Stadium, initially occurring in the park's first season, 1970, which concluded with one of the most memorable moments in the game's 82-year history, centered on the city's most famous player. For Tom Verducci, it's his second All-Star game as a color commentator, having been to several more during his esteemed writing career with Newsday and Sports Illustrated. Our discussion took place in early June, just prior to the development surrounding Pete Rose, who will be a major focus of the festivities. Tom, as you get ready to call this year's All-Star game in Cincinnati for Fox alongside Joe Buck and Harold Reynolds, I wanted to ask you about last year's game, which was your first in the analyst role. Did you sort of have the feeling, the nervousness, and the excitement akin to maybe a ball player who was making his All-Star debut?
Well, certainly excitement. I mean, you can just feel it in the ballpark even before everything starts that there's something special about that game. I mean, just to be around all those All-Stars itself, it's kind of exciting. So to call the game from the broadcast booth is a whole different level of excitement. It's a fun game to do. It's also a very difficult game to do because you have so many changes throughout the game, so many players getting in the game. And the game is actually played at a faster pace than a normal major league game. Pitchers are on the attack all the time, and hitters are much more aggressive swinging. So the pace of the game is very different.
Over the past decade and a half, there's been a rapid increase in sports writers who have worked in other platforms, radio and television specifically. A lot has to do with the dying nature of the print industry. But dating back to when you were writing for the Penn State News student newspaper, Newsday, and even with Sports Illustrated, did you ever envision not just being on television, but being in the broadcast booth?
No, there's no way you could have envisioned it back then the way the landscape was in the media business, because back then you were either in the print business or you were in the electronic business. And there was, for lack of a better phrase, a firewall between the two of them. You know, with rare exceptions, people just didn't go back and forth. And in fact, you really didn't look on the other side, so to speak, with any kind of admiration or longing to join them. So that was what the media landscape was back in the 80s. So to sit here and say, hey, you know, maybe someday I'll do both, that just wasn't on my radar and probably anybody's radar. It goes to show you how quickly things have changed.
In terms of how you gather information from players, coaches, and managers, is there any difference between the ways you'd prepare for a column, a feature story, or a game story from how you get ready for a broadcast?
You know, in general, I will say no, in that gathering information, to me, I equate it to modern police work. You know, as much evidence finding ways that we have now, the methodologies have changed, but certainly science playing the role. And just if you watch primetime TV, you get an idea of that with all the CSI shows that are out there. It still comes down to that cop on the street being able at ground level to gather information from sources and developing trust with sources. It's really the same way in journalism. It still comes down to personal relationships and getting information. So that hasn't changed. But in terms of technology, I think the biggest change has been the availability of information and especially video. Back in the day, when I first started, certainly at Sports Illustrated, if you wanted some really specialized statistical information, you'd have to put in a request with an organization like the Alliance Sports Bureau. It may take a few days before you get something back. You pay for those services. And now, with a few clicks, you can find so much information that used to literally take days and money to acquire. And more recently, I think the fact that there's so much video out there, with every game now being available and being streamed and archived, it's very easy to start breaking down hitters and pitchers and look at certain things that they do mechanically or recent histories. That certainly has changed. So the amount of information that's out there now is just incredible. Leaps and bounds from where it was even 10 years ago.
Now, with each All-Star game, it's only natural to look back at the history of the game. And with this one being in Cincinnati, I think most memories will circle back to the 1970 game at Riverfront Stadium with Pete Rose barreling into Ray Fosse to score the winning run for the National League.
Yeah, I mean, that is not just for Cincinnati, but for a lot of fans, such an indelible moment. It really, in one play, I think, epitomized the player that Pete Rose was. I mean, here it was, a game that, quote-unquote, didn't count back then. And he's going all out, and certainly the collision at home plate, which actually changed the career of Ray Fosse, is a great all-star moment, but a great baseball moment as well, and it happened in his hometown, was just icing on the cake as far as making that an indelible moment. But I think those kind of things, I mean, the all-star game to me in baseball, unlike any other sports all-star game, has kind of these indelible moments that you just don't forget. The other games can be entertaining, but in terms of historic value, things that really last a lifetime and beyond, baseball gives you more of those moments than any other sport.
1-1 to the waiting Jim Hickman, and right into the stretch, looking back and throws up the middle. Rose is on his way around, picked up by Otis. Rose is coming to the plate, throws a throw. He's in. It's all over. The National League win. Barreled into Ray Fosse, who was slow in getting up, trying to block the plate. The ball wasn't there yet, and Rose just rolled her shoulder into him, and Fosse is being led away. But the National League is now on its eighth in a row. A line drive single of the Chicago Cubs, Jim Hickman, scores Cincinnati's Pete Rose.
You know, Rose was, and he was on the extreme end of this, but I think we've seen a decline kind of in the competitive nature of the All-Star game, and that comes with the expanding of the rosters and then trying to get all the players on those rosters some playing time, as well as the division between the two leagues not being strong. Major League Baseball has tried to do something with this since that tie in 2002 by granting home field advantage in the World Series to the winning league, but to some critics it hasn't been enough. Do you think, especially with the current generation of young players, the Trouts, the Kershaws, and the McCutcheons, that we'll again see some semblance of the way it used to be?
That's a great question. I think in terms of the way it used to be, in terms of league pride, I don't think we'll see that. I think interleague play has taken away some of that sort of intrigue, if you will. A lot of times, at least when I was a kid, you look forward to matchups that you would never see before. Reggie Jackson against Tom Seaver. I mean, you can only see those kind of matchups in the World Series if they happen. So we won't get back to that kind of, I call it a mystery to individual matchups. And even league pride, I think, has been diminished because there's so much player movement in the game today. All these guys seem to be of one fraternity rather than of two leagues. So it's difficult to get that back. I think if you're looking to get anything back on the competitive side, to me, what I would do is I would restrict the active roster to 25 players, and I would play it like a real game. I think there are too many players who go to the All-Star game that are named All-Stars, and the managers, for some reason, find a need to get everybody in the game like it's middle school kickball. And I would run a game like I'd run a regular major league game. And the people, certainly the fans, want to see certain players that get voted in as all-stars. I'd much rather think the fans want to see the greatest plays, Mike Trout's, the Miguel Cabrera's, take their three or four at-bats rather than take one or two at-bats and be sitting on the bench.
Now, for you, growing up in New Jersey, did you have any fond memories of watching the All-Star game as a kid, aside from maybe 1970? Any other games that are moments that stick out to you?
Well, for me, I always liked to watch the games, especially kind of like the different shoes guys would wear. You know, once in a while, guys would be wearing a white shoe, other than the Oakland A's, who always wore them. Again, I was looking at matchups, and, these guys never faced one another before, and who's going to win the pitcher-hitter battle. Just kind of the pageantry and the spectacle of it, all the different uniforms. I love the fact that they do have each guy wears their own personal uniform, their team's uniform, rather than wearing a generic league uniform like they did at the Home Run Derby. That was a must-see event because you knew you were looking at something very unique. I mean, in a season with more than 2,000 games, the All-Star game literally stands out as something unlike anything else just in terms of how it looks on television.
And in transitioning to a print reporter, what do you recall from your first All-Star assignment?
Yeah, I mean, all kinds of different things. I mean, I remember the long game at Wrigley Field, the pitcher's duel with Julio Franco getting the winning hit. I thought watching an All-Star game at Wrigley Field was really cool, with the historic backdrop at the ballpark. And actually, as a reporter, the best day is the day before, and it's not because of the Home Run Derby, which seems to drag on and on. It's the fact that they get the players in ballrooms, and you know, you'll never see a collection of baseball talent in one room together like you will on that day. And a chance to talk to, just walk around the room and talk to as many players as you can get in an hour and a half. If for a reporter, I mean, that's like nirvana, the fact that you have so many great players available to talk to. So that's always a thrill every year.
And for added nostalgia, Major League Baseball implemented the Franchise Four this year, in which fans vote on the four most impactful players in each team's history, and that will be revealed in a pregame ceremony. The vote for the Reds, I think, is a foregone conclusion, as we talked about, for the hometown legend Pete Rose. And I think his appearance is going to generate a reaction that will certainly surpass the one we saw at the 1999 World Series. I think it was Game 2, in which they did the All-Century team, especially since it's in his hometown, and also especially because his chances for reinstatement, or at least eligibility for the Hall of Fame, seem to be increasing.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, no matter what the circumstances, what the ceremony is, and Pete Rose, we all expect, will be a part of the game to some shape or form. He's going to be a show stealer. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he's still popular around the country, but never more so than in Cincinnati. So I'm looking forward to that. I mean, I think it's a great venue. It's just great that it's in Cincinnati where he can be honored. It's interesting about the reinstatement issue. I think a lot of people get confused about that. I understand, and probably Pete looks this way too, now that we have a new commissioner, that his chances have improved. I guess that may be literally true if you are of the opinion that under Bud Selig his chances were zero. but I still don't know about that. I think what people do is they confuse reinstatement with his Hall of Fame eligibility. It's hard to imagine that a guy who bet on baseball will be reinstated fully to the game, where he's welcome to go anywhere, put on a uniform, be a coach, even as a part-time spring training instructor. That's difficult to imagine. But I'll go back to when Bart Giamatti, the commissioner, when Rose did sign the agreement to be banned from baseball, was asked about whether that ban would affect Pete's eligibility for the Hall of Fame, and the commissioner who threw Pete Rose out said, basically, no, that's up to you guys, the writers, to decide. Well, it never did get to us, the writers, because the Hall of Fame passed a measure designed to keep Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame, or at least off the ballot, to say that anybody eligible or anybody on the ineligible list would not be eligible for the Hall of Fame ballot. So until that changes, I don't see Pete getting into the Hall of Fame, and I think that's where the discussion should start about whether he should be on a ballot or not.
Based on the most up-to-date results with that Franchise Four, and I'm not sure how closely you've looked at them, the most up-to-date results are April 22nd, but are there any specific team votes that stood out to you or you think will be closely contested right until the end?
Well, it's interesting. I'm interested to see how many different teams Nolan Ryan will show up on. I think he's been on three different teams in terms of the ballot, and he may actually win a place on three different teams, which would be unbelievable when you think about it. You know, I was really curious to see how the Yankees vote would turn out, because to me, you know, they have their Mount Rushmore. We talk about Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, and Mantle. But let's face it, we have a lot of people watching the game today who know those guys only from history books, and, you know, especially the younger fan who grew up with guys like Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera as their Ruth and Gehrig, will carry, obviously, a lot of sway in the vote. So I'm really curious to see how much of the modern fan's impact is going to be show up in a team like the Yankees, who, to me, it's a no-brainer that those are the top four. They're the four guys who are no longer with us. But I'll be interested to see how the modern player shows up in that vote.
Yeah, going back to Nolan Ryan, I was going to ask you, I mean, is he going to wear three different hats? Because I think he's leading, or he's in the top four in all three in the latest results. Yeah, I was wondering if he's going to wear three different hats, or he's going to wear a hat with, like, Astros, Angels, and Rangers colors, like, all mixed together. They're going to make one special for him.
Yeah, Yeah, that reminds me of when Gaylord Perry used to participate in old-timers games. He used to wear a specially made uniform that had the logos of all the teams that he played on. It's a lot of teams.
A lot of stitching.
It was a very busy jersey.
Yeah, and the Yankees, the latest results for the Yankees were Ruth, Gehrig, Mantle, and DiMaggio, I believe, in that order. So, you know, your Jeters and Mariano Rivera and Yogi Berra and Whitey Ford were outside the top four. But that's, you know, that's a debate. It seems like we go over, you know, whenever a great Yankee is retiring, like we did last year or the year before with Rivera. It's kind of a common debate. It's never one that's like pops up once every 20 years. It's one that pops up like seems like every 5 years. So that's kind of a common one. And it's almost where you can't even go wrong if you, you know, include Yogi Berra, you include Derek Jeter, you have a case for all of them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, to me, I said no-brainers for that top four, but anytime you're making an argument for players like Yogi Berra, Derek Jeter, and Mariano Rivera, I mean, they're some of the best to ever play their positions, regardless of what franchise you're talking about. To say that it's wrong to include them, I think, is not appropriate. So it's one of the great debates, I mean, not just for the Yankees, but for any team. We all like to rank players and who's better than this guy and that guy. And certainly when you're talking about guys at this level, you know, there's room for argument for everybody.
And now the starting lineup, batting first and playing center field from the San Francisco Giants. Here is Willie Mays. Batting second and playing right field from the Milwaukee Braves, here is Hank Aaron. He'll be in right field batting second. Aaron.
Aside from the individual teams, there is also a voting for the greatest living players. Right now, it's Hank Aaron, Willie Mays on top with Sandy Koufax and Tom Seaver making up the top four. Ricky Henderson and Barry Bonds are on the outside looking in. I can't imagine anyone would disagree with the first two being Aaron and Mays. I think that's a lock. But do you think someone like a Ricky Henderson or even a Barry Bonds deserves to be among the top four?
Yeah, this is going to be fascinating, and I think it depends on how people define, you know, who these guys are. When you talk about living legends, is it the best? Is it the most impactful? Is it guys who at their peak were at their best? Or are you looking at greatest careers? I mean, it's a fascinating discussion because it all depends on how you define it. I agree with you. I think Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, they should be no-brainers. I expect that they will be there in the final four. Hard to argue against a guy like Sandy Koufax, who is, you know, that's baseball royalty. You just mentioned the name, and you think of living legend. You know, certainly Tom Seaver in that same regard. I'm not sure there's been a better right-handed pitcher since Walter Johnson. But I'm glad you brought up Ricky Henderson. I think he tends to be underrated among all-time greats. When you talk about an entire package of skills, Ricky Henderson had it as well as anybody in baseball. Really was a game changer in every definition of the words, because, I mean, just look at his stolen base total. Nobody's close to him. The run scored, all-time leader. Played so long and played so well for so long. And I also have to throw in there Pedro Martinez. I mean, I think he's kind of the Koufax of our generation, with probably a longer career, maybe even a better peak. And I think he deserves to be mentioned in the top four. Bond is a guy I would not have in the top four because of his association with steroids. I recognize that his greatness as a player, for sure. But when you're talking about the best of the best, I got to go with the guys that we know are without the use of performance enhancers.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on that. And I bring up Henderson just because I think of all the, you know, he doesn't have the pop, of course. He has the stolen bases, he has the on-base percentage, he has the walks and all of that. Tom Seaver, personally, I'm not old enough to have watched him, but he's my favorite player being a Mets fan, so I certainly voted for him, but I don't think I would argue with Ricky Henderson jumping in there in the top four, but the other three I certainly agree with.
Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating vote, because I think you're really talking about what six guys for two spots when you look at it, assuming that Mays and Aaron are locks, and they should be. You know, even a guy like Johnny Bench, you can say, deserves consideration, because when you look at the catcher position, I think most people regard him as the greatest catcher of all time. And, you know, look at any other position on the field, and it's difficult to identify one guy definitively as the very absolute best at his position. And I think most people say that about Johnny Bench, with all due respect to Yogi Berra. And you're talking about, again, someone who changed the game because of the way defensively behind the plate with his throwing ability and the one-handed catching style. That's another guy who deserves to be in the conversation as well. So it'll be very close vote, I would assume, for those last two spots.
Well, we'll certainly be watching for those final results and very much looking forward to watching and hearing you on the call on Fox. Thanks so much, Tom. Enjoy the game.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Earlier, Tom mentioned how Ray Fosse never was the same after being on the receiving end of the collision with Pete Rose in 1970. Although Fosse would be selected to another All-Star game the next season and won two World Series, the separated shoulder he suffered on that night in Cincinnati never fully recovered. Rose, meanwhile, would be a part of 17 All-Star teams. Brian Wright, hoping you enjoyed this special edition of Baseball As It Was.